This is Jeff Chrisman, and I'm here this afternoon at the Art Hall in Uptown on 23rd Street in Oklahoma City, and I'm visiting with poet and author and also comedian, Catherine Katie Johnson. Catherine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And I want to double check and make sure as I was reading, or as I was saying those different things, I want to make sure I did. I didn't know if I left anything out.
Artist.
Very good. Very good.
Thanks.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I have, since I met you at the that opening that was a few weeks back here at IAO, I have heard so many good things about you from other people.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I must say that, you know, it really does, you know, this is really illustrates that you are, you know, clearly very entrenched in this community and very much a part of the community.
Well, thank you so much for saying that.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought what we might do is maybe if you wanted to, before I was going to, you know, I'm very interested to ask you about your life story and your life journey, but I thought maybe for listeners, if there are some listeners who maybe aren't as familiar with you, to maybe hear just a little bit about, you know, your various works and just, you know, a little more about what you do overall.
Okay. Be glad to answer those questions.
Sure. Sure.
I am a, I started out a visual artist, studied acting and stuff in high school and won a bunch of state competitions. But after I got married out of high school and had children, then I calmed down and found visual arts to be the tool to express myself. And so I started painting professionally in the 70s, early 70s. And then when my starter husband and I parted ways, then I became a full-time artist and worked at a gallery and managed it. And I've been painting ever since. And I do, in 1980, I switched over to abstract expressionism. And it has been my tool ever since. I up until the time when Continental took over the tower down, Mid-America Tower downtown, when Devin was in it for 19 years, the building itself commissioned me to do a mural 20 feet by 7 feet in 1992, and it was completed in 93, and it was up the whole time Devin was in the Mid-America Tower, but Mr. Hamm decided to put his oil derricks up in its place. So there you have it.
Yeah.
And my most recent exhibit was at Biting the Apple at IAO.
Oh, okay.
And I sold a piece there that was a female torso, nude torso, collaged out of postage stamps. And it was called Male, M-A-I-L, Female.
Very interesting. Yeah.
And Doug, what's his last name? It'll come to me. At Dunlop Cotting, he purchased it. And Doug Sirocco.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I was thrilled about that. So, anyhow.
Yeah.
That's the art thing.
Sure.
And then in about 83, I guess, a girlfriend of mine and I kidnapped a comedian, luring him at the invitation of a home-cooked meal. And we went over to another friend's house, and she fixed a nice meal for him. And I picked his brain about doing stand-up. And so he said, you just got to get out there, and it's like riding a bicycle. Plan on falling on your face a few times, and then you'll get the hang of it. And so I started doing stand-up. And in 86, I changed my name for that to Cary Grant. That was kind of a fluke. And I met Pat Paulson shortly after that, and he said, you know, this name is genius. And I said, oh, it is. He said, yeah. He said, you know why? Because people already know to remember it.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, well, okay, I'm going to keep it then. So, and then I switched the visual art over to Cary Grant also, since it was a little bit odd also.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Are there any, I guess if I could ask you, as far as your comedic perspective, are there certain subjects that you tend to talk about more, you know, more frequently than others? Or is that evolved over the years?
One of the things that I do, is sequels for movies. I like to play with that.
Yeah.
And so like the 2019 Oscars that were up, I did sequels for all of those. And like, for example, up for Best Picture was Black Panther. And the sequel to it is actually a prequel called The Black Panther Party. And it's a beach party movie featuring the music of Huey Newton.
Oh, wow. I like it, yeah.
And like the movie Kong Skull Island, that has a sequel. You may not have heard of it. It's called Kong Skull Island. But the censors aren't letting it be released. They're saying it's a snuff film.
That's great.
So that kind of
yeah.
Thing. But then I do, you know, things like I live in a gated community. You may have heard of it, the United States.
Absolutely. It makes you think. Yeah. It makes you think. Yeah.
He put the P in president.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Do you, as far as your comedy, I mean, do you tend, before you go up on stage, do you have some idea of some things that you're going to talk about, or does it kind of tend to flow more naturally? Or?
Alex Sanchez, I started out doing open mic when I came back into it in the 80s, I guess, 80, no, in the, God, 2010. I had taken a hiatus because I had a state job, and they tend to frown on people making too much fun of too many things that might have consequences, and so I concentrated on the art during those years, and then in 2010 retired, and I was getting ready to have a pacemaker put in, and I ran into a comedian that I worked with before. And he had a stent in for radiation. I mean, we were both falling apart, you know. And he said, where have you been? You got to get back on stage. And I'm going, well, I'm getting a, you know. And he said, oh, it doesn't matter. You've got to get back up there. So I went to 51st Street Speakeasy, and Brad Chad Porter was the MC and managed the club, I guess, there. And so it was 2 days after my pacemaker surgery. My arm was still in a sling. And I walked in carrying jumper cables.
Oh, my goodness.
And I handed him one end of the jumper cables. And I said, now just hang on to that. And I clipped the other one to the mic stand. And I said, this is just in case. I just had a pacemaker put in. You know, so that's how it started back.
Oh, yeah.
And just been having a great time. But one of the things that I tend to do is I'm one of the few people they tolerate heckling from. Hmm. And it's just because I'll think of something that needs to be said in addition to whatever anyone else has said. And most all the comedians are pretty tolerant of it. And it, you know, it always brings a laugh. And so they both think it's great.
Oh, yeah.
Matt Rainey and Alex Sanchez does public access now, which is over on Paseo, and I go there every chance I get. So.
Yeah. I was curious, too, just in terms of, you know, if that has changed you at all in terms of just how you look at life, or maybe, you know, is it as far as the experience of performing comedy, maybe, you know, how that has affected you overall, or what you feel like you get out of that?
Comedy was my survival tool.
Oh.
And as you probably read, growing up wasn't the happiest of times, and there was lots of arguing. Lots of arguing. My dad was a lawyer. My mother was a legal stenographer for another lawyer. And so they were always arguing cases, you know, just cases they had with each other, you know. And so comedy was sort of my tool for coping with that and dealing with it, you know. And it has served me well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I toured a little bit with it, and I've been on stage at the Comedy Store and Laugh Factory and a lot of those clubs out on the West Coast, and I've done comedy club in New York City once. Tough crowd.
Yeah, I imagine they don't. I imagine they take that really seriously.
Yeah,
don't they?
But I've done Minnesota and Florida and Arkansas and just a number of different other states, Kentucky and Indiana. So, you know, it's something I enjoyed doing when I did it. I don't have that burning desire to be a comedian, you know, full-time right now, just because it's pretty grueling. It's intense. You never know when you're going to get stiffed on payment, you know. And so you need to have a big nest egg before you go on the road. I did at one time, but it has since gone away. So, but I switched over. Also, I got bit by the writing bug. And I actually was on a stage crew with the Church of Tomorrow Jewel Box Theater, and they brought a visiting playwright from UCO. His name was Ralph Pape, and I went to the after party, and it turned out that he was good friends with Danny DeVito. And so we talked quite a little bit, and he said, well, you should come and take my playwriting class. And I thought, well, that's a good way to suck up to him, you know. So I did. And unfortunately, the writing bug bit me instead. And it has not let up. And so it's led to other adventures like the poetry and Pody Poet book and all of that stuff.
Oh, yeah. That's what I was going to say. And I know when I met you, you had shared with me the is this your most recent book, The 50 Shades
of
Grey?
Yes, I've got another one I'm working on right now called Tsunami of Love. And I hope to have it out in about a month.
Yeah.
So I've got I'm booked as the guest poet at the, I think it's called the Vineyard in Drumright, Oklahoma. It's a winery, and that's in May, and so I hope to have a book there for that.
Oh, yeah. And as far as I was going to ask you, too, in terms of, do you do quite a bit of public readings as far as going to poetry open mics?
Yes, yes. And yeah. I've been featured at the IAO, and I've been featured at Full Circle and several other places, and I've been a Woody Guthrie poet for 8 years now, and always do readings for that, and I've been in two or three anthologies with them, so, and they have a call for submissions right now and they're going to print another book, so I'll be in that. And then the Beat Poets, I met George Wallace. He was one of three poets that founded the Woody Guthrie Poets here in conjunction with the festival, but it's a separate entity. And George is the poetry editor for the Long Islander, which is the newspaper that Walt Whitman founded. And he manages Walt's Corner in that newspaper, and I've been featured in it 3 times, I think. And so he was real encouraging, and he's a beat poet. And so with Facebook, the beat poets kind of got organized and came together, and now it's an international group, and they're national and international beat poet laureates, and there are beat poet laureates in the States also, and several of them anyway. We don't have one here yet, but I'm hoping that we'll get one soon.
Oh yeah.
But my poem Chicklets, which was in that, was featured in their 10-year anniversary anthology called Beatitude.
Yeah. In fact, I was going to ask you, just from, I've heard that term before. I didn't know if there's a specific type of poetry, as far as beat poetry itself, or maybe just...
Yeah, it's, it started in the 50s. It was a vanguard at the time, but it's something with a rhythm to it, with a heartbeat to it, many times in the early days it was accompanied by bongo drums and beatniks, in coffee houses and all of that, and that's where the snapping, came from. But there are some fabulous poets in that, and it's kind of like a beat in film writing, the beat, when you get into a scene and you tell what you have to tell, then you need to get out of it because you've already done the beat, and you don't need to do that again because you've already completed the beat, and so that I kind of draw from it, as well as the rhythm to the poetry. But it's something that takes you on a little bit of a journey, and hopefully reaches in there and grabs you a little bit. So.
Yeah, I was unfortunately a little bit too young to actually, I'd heard a lot of stories. I've always been fascinated with the coffee houses and things like that. And I guess was that in the late 50s and,
yes,
and through the 60s?
Yes,
and
early 60s here. And we actually had coffee houses here that had beat poets.
Interesting. I was going to ask you about that. I'd love to. I didn't realize. I always wondered if there were any of those.
My dad took me to one.
And, oh, my goodness.
So that was early impression, and then of course some of the movies, like the guy that played on Gilligan's Island, Bob Denver.
I think so.
Yeah, he was in some movie when he was a beatnik,
I feel like I remember that. I have faint memories of that.
It's one of those beach party movies.
Yeah.
So. And then in 94, I was going to school at UCO because, like I said, I got derailed from the writing, and they offered a trip to New York to the beat poet gathering at NYU.
Oh my goodness.
And they had all of them there, with the exception of William Burroughs, because he escaped the United States to avoid prosecution. But Hunter Thompson was there.
Oh my goodness.
Gregory Corso, Ken Kesey, David Amram, all of these guys. And it was just in Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I met a writer there who took an interest in my work, and he and his wife invited me to his 80th birthday party in January after that. And a friend of mine and I went up there, and we needed to stay in a cheap place, which is not easy to find on New Year's in New York City. But she was with the education department, and they had a way of staying in people's homes for not too much money, so she hooked us up through that. And there was a lady named Mona that we were going to call right before we got there, And so we called her to double check the accommodations. It was like $35 each a night.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
it was in Hell's Kitchen, you know. real close to where the ball drops, you know. And so we called her and said, well, is it still on? And she said, yes, actually, you won't be staying with me. You'll be staying with a gentleman friend of mine. And we're looking at each other, and she said, his name is Frank Nastasi.
Oh, my goodness.
And he's a very private person. And we said, great, we're going to be an alibi for the mafia. So we got up there, and Frank Nastasi was actually a Soupy sales partner on children's TV for 25 years.
Oh, okay.
He was also in Golden Boy with Sammy Davis Jr., and they toured England as well as New York City. And he was delightful, absolutely delightful. And, you know, we got to see the prop from the Soupy Sales show of the White Fang and Black Tooth, the paws, you know, that would come through the door going,
oh, yeah.
And Soupy would tell you what he said. And so we just had a great time up there, you know, and went to the New Year's and got some of those balloons from the policeman there, you know, and we were about 75 feet from Dick Clark. So we came to the birthday party the next day, and his son was out on the landing, and I said, Jason, tell your dad these are actual New Year's Eve balloons that we're bringing. And he said, oh, well, we'll let you in anyway.
Sounds like that was sounds like those were some good memories.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I was wondering too, I didn't know if there were any prominent riders. I know what I'm born and raised in Tulsa, not that this is about me, but I remember there were three, I believe it was Joe Brainerd and Ron Padgett, and there was one, and the name is just escaping me. They were kind of referred to as the Tulsa School of poetry. And these guys actually went to Central High School in Tulsa, graduated like in the late 50s, and then moved to New York City. So I wasn't sure if there were any, you know, if there's anybody here from Oklahoma City that was really, you know, notable from that time.
The one that comes to mind is Frank Parman. And Frank Parman had the Point Writers Press here. And when I was on Paseo, I had a studio there for a couple of years. And Frank was in that building, and he did typesetting for the Gaily Oklahoman. He was a playwright first and poet second, I guess. But he also published for a lot of wonderfully established poets like Arne Anderson and, you know, just a lot of them, and Lance Hansen, and Frank, we lost him a couple of years ago, but he was a great inspiration also. Yeah,
and I was, I guess to kind of transition, I was wanting to actually ask you, I've had a chance to read through most of 50 Shades of Grey here. I've really taken some time to, instead of just trying to read it from cover to cover, you know, I've really tried to take some time and read one particular poem and then kind of sit with that a little bit.
I'm honored.
And I have to tell you that this is, as someone who is starting to experience some of, you know, of aging, of, you know, going, you know, through middle age and life feeling different than it did 20 years ago and 30 years ago, I have to tell you the honesty and the authenticity of this. And I didn't know if you wanted to share just anything about your experiences of writing this or what it means to you personally.
I wrote that book, the poem, Old is Fast. That was the first one in the series of poems about aging and the process. And I was having so much trouble trying to get my medications right and And, you know, I had gone through several surgeries in a short period of time, and you know, it just wasn't a whole lot of fun. But being the ever optimist, I was always trying to, you know, I kept thinking, with all of this horse poop, there's bound to be a pony here somewhere, you know. And so one night I was having trouble, you know. I got up to go pee, because that's what we do in the middle of the night, and really had to hang on to the walls, because it was just like I was so dizzy from the medications and stuff. And I got back, and I said, boy, old is fast, you know. And then I went, yeah, it is, that's true. And so I started in jotting some ideas down, and that's how that poem evolved, was from actually experiencing all of what was there, with the exception of the perspective of the guy at the end. You know, there was no guy in the TV tray, you know, but I had to get equal time, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So put that in there, and then just as things progressed, I started noticing other things, you know, and I have a couple of poems that deal with my dog. I lost my dog in October this last year, but she was great entertainment and a great source for inspiration and a great source for perspiration, because, you know, she yanked me off the porch a couple of times, and first time I let it slide, the second time we had a come to Jesus meeting in the front yard, you know. She never yanked me off again.
Yeah, and I find it really interesting so if I understand you right, you know, going through what you went through with the, you know, with the difficulties with your medication, that you actually started, the ideas started, that you started kind of putting that together that same night.
Yeah, and yeah. Just with one poem, and then a friend of mine said, well, I've figured out your, it was a very dear friend, the one I went to New York with, and she said, well, I've got the name for your sequel to Old is Fast. And I said, what's that? And she said, Fat is Slow.
And that comes right after it, doesn't
right.
it?
Right. Yes. And so I went, oh, okay. You know, and so I thought about that, and so that's how that developed, you know, and of course I mentioned the book in there, you know, so it's just about the adventure of life, you know, and I do consider it an adventure. Dr. Andrew Horton, who's a good friend of mine, he taught film and video studies at OU for many, many years, and he wrote Brad Pitt's first starring role in a movie called The Dark Side, A Dark Side of the Sun. And so his attitude is that life is a carnival, and mine is an adventure, you know. So
yeah,
maybe if I thought it was a carnival, it would have been a little more fun.
Yeah, and one of the things that strikes me about this is, as I was reading it, though, that, you know, I do, even though you were talking about, you know, some serious topics, there was, I was always getting a sense every step of the way that there was some light, you know, it also felt that there was a degree of lightheartedness to it,
yes.
That it wasn't a, yeah, it's yeah. It's very interesting how that even though sometimes things, you know, you were in the midst of things that were going on, but there was always like you were keeping your sense of humor.
Right.
I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth. But.
Like the trip to New York that we went on, there were two vans, 21 students, you know, and so it was a bit of a chaotic trip up there and back, you know, and we were, it's students, so we're staying on the cheap, you know, and so we had stayed at this one motel called the Crown Inn, and we theorized it was because they come in at night and crown you and take your money and everything. And for example, our room had no knob on it, you know, and so our sponsor professor, she got a chair and butted it up against the door, and these 8 or 10 young, mostly young student petite gals, you know, were staying in there with just this lady's body keeping them safe, you know. And the window, we didn't open it because it had a diagonal crack across it, you know.
Oh,
and
okay.
So on the way back, we stayed at a little better motels, and our professor, Dr. Hockenauer, went in to check out this one place and said, ask about our family rates, you know. And, and so he got out, and he was going to go in and do that. And I said, tell him it's the Manson family. You
know? That probably would really got their attention, I would think. Yeah, I would have to, and I guess the one thing I wanted to say to you too is that after reading this, it has really, in some way, has affected the way, I just get more of a sense of that it's, you know, I realize we're all aging, you know, I know that there's not really anything we can do about this, but for some reason, even just in my own life, I have found that there's just, it's for some reason after reading this, I get a little more of a sense that it's okay, maybe, that it's
absolutely
not
absolutely okay.
Yeah. I hope it's okay to say that.
Absolutely, yeah. And I really have reached a point at my in my life where I'm just, you know, enjoying the experience of living, you know. I stopped listening to too much politics because that was getting my blood pressure up a little too much, you know. And having worked at the state, I know that there's not a whole hell of a lot you can do about much of it, you know. You can be active on a grassroots level, and I try to do that. And you can certainly vote, and I would encourage more people to vote because that is your voice in politics, you know. And if you want it to get to a point where things are working in your favor, you've got to get active, and you've got to make calls for people, and you've got to write to your government and tell them your opinion, you know, make those phone calls. And it's so important to do that. And but that's where it kind of ends for me. You know, someone said, well, why don't you run? And I said, there is not enough tea in China to get me to run for office, you know.
Yeah. But it is very inspirational, though. I mean, I definitely get this sense after, you know, speaking with you that, you know, that you are still, you have these things that you enjoy doing that you're very actively involved in and that mean a lot to you.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, I don't really understand. I mean, I can understand some people if they have a physical limitation, you know, which they tell me I have physical limitations. But, you know, I can understand someone staying at home because of that. But for someone to be an able-bodied person and be twiddling their thumbs going, what do I do with all of this time? It just blows my mind, you know, because you don't need a whole lot of money to live here like you do in New York. There are a lot of things that are free. This wonderful gallery that we're in, you know, you can come and go and see artwork and sit in front of it and contemplate it. You know, the IAO is fabulous.
Oh, yeah.
There are just so many things one can do. Arts Place actually has a lot of, art space has a lot of things to do. And most of those things with the arts community don't cost money. Ralph Ellison Foundation, that has a wonderful workshop once a month you can go to. And so why not?
Oh, yeah. And all this sounds like all these open mics, if I understand, those are all generally free of charge?
Yes.
And the poetry readings?
We have usually about 7 open mics during the week. Some have 2 on one night. Sunday nights are active. And so unless you pay to park in Bricktown, you know, you can get through open mics pretty cheap also.
Yeah. It's very inspiring to know that there really are a lot. Yeah, that's kind of like you said, you're saying that there's, you know, people can't really say that there aren't things to do.
Yeah. And the comedians that are here, I mean, I know probably 70 comedians in the metro area and a few in Tulsa, and the comedians that are here are really funny people. You know, they do work on their craft. They do write their stuff every week, and Matt's just a genius, you know, and he's taken some chances and gone to Chicago, and he's been working in Dallas now, you know, and for a person who's younger, that's what you do. And they are all working on their craft, and so you're seeing some top-notch talent developing, and what a ride, you know, to be able to watch that.
Yeah, that's, and I was amazed to find out how many open mics there are, you know, comedy open mics there actually are here.
And I have to say, put in a plug for music, OCU, I studied voice there for several years, and my mother wanted me to be an opera singer. I wanted to sing and be a lounge lizard and stop and tell jokes, you know, so we didn't communicate that drive real well. but OCU is pretty close to where I live, and I enjoy going up there and listen to their student works, and they have a conductor, I think his name is Jeff Grogan, and he is a mad genius. I mean, the guy is so inspiring, and he, you know, shows his kids that classical music doesn't have to be stuffy, you know, and stuff. It's just incredible to watch him at work. And one of the students who graduated this last December, her name is Ren Fall, P-F-A-L. Ren is a middle name of my granddaughter that lives in Arizona. And so Ren caught my eye, you know, on Facebook, you know, and she plays the flute just perfectly. And so I've been following her career for about a year and a half, you know, and then she graduated. But, you know, we're still friends on Facebook and everything. But you can go to those concerts at the Wanda Bass School of Music at OCU for free.
Oh, wow.
You know, and you're hearing some incredible, incredible talent up there, and teaching the kids to enjoy their musical instruments, not just, you know, carry them, lug them into the practice hall, you know. It's just marvelous to see that.
Yeah, it really is very inspiring to know that there are so many different activities, and you have people with different interests, and it's just a matter of kind of availing ourselves of those things.
And the Norick Art Center there is one of the best I've ever been to, and many years ago in '88, I think it was, my ex-wife-in-law and I had a two-person show there.
Oh, wow.
And it was supposed to originally be my most recent ex-husband and I, which was our mutual ex-husband, and he lost his mind, and we had to run him out of the state, and so that left a void, you know, in my plan. And one day she called and said, "Have you found anyone to take his place?" And I said, "No," and she said, "Well, I could do it with you." And I said, "Oh, that'd be great." And she said, "And I figured out the name for it." And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Ex-Wives Collide."
That's great.
And we had both had minor car accidents in the front end of our cars. And so we lined them up so that the damage was,
rigged.
And then I had paint, cans of paint pouring out of my engine, and my son-in-law at the time threw hot water onto the engine so that steam would rise, because it was in the cold winter, you know. And so then we exchanged driver's license in another picture, you know, and stuff. And so that was the front of the invitation. And it was the best responded to that date show that they had had at the Norick.
Oh, wow.
And there was a professor who is now a very accomplished artist here, Thomas Batista, and he has a studio at 30th and Walker, and he taught a little mini course on me, because he started talking to me and went, "Really?" And then, "Really?"
He's writing it all down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So She's a, Martha Green is my ex-wife-in-law, and she's a quilter extraordinaire. She's taught in France. She's, you know, gone all over the place, and she does crazy quilts, and she has the Kearney School of Crazy Quilts, you know, that, and so life's a carnival for her, and so she does a lot of these carnival freak show characters in her quilting, and she's been at JRB Gallery for many, many years, and so we did that show together, but our collision was in our approach to using acrylic paint. She had these segregated color planes, much like a quilt, and I did drippy layers of very loose acrylic paint, you know, and so layered it, you know, and so it was really an approach to using the media, medium that collided.
But
we're still very dear, dear friends, and in fact, I talked to her last night. So,
That's great. That's. And then the last thing I was going to talk to you about, and I think when I met you at IAO, this is one of the things that you were talking about that really, really got my attention, and I had not heard of him before. And if I can't remember if I'm saying his name right, is it Pody
Poe?
Okay.
Yeah,
and this, and just, you know, you'd given me just kind of a little bit of an overview of the story, and I found myself just completely drawn in almost immediately.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know if you wanted to maybe just, you know, for listeners to, you know, to kind of maybe get some sense of, and you've written an entire book about his story.
Yeah. The book is Pody Poe, From Tin Horn Gambler to Kingpin of Organized Crime. It's out of print now. But it is sold secondarily on the Amazon. He got out of prison. He beat the FBI three times at bats, and the fourth time they got him for tax problems because he had stopped paying attention. He was a little bit of an alcoholic and a little messed up from a few little powdery substances, and so he wound up getting sentenced to prison, and when he got out of prison, he wanted to tell his life story, and so he started asking about people who were writers, and a friend of his knew a friend of mine, and she recommended me, and so we met, and we got along pretty good, and we started working on the book. It took about 4 years, actually, because it was a lot of stuff I had to go through, you know, and I did go through it, and it's a pretty fascinating story. When it was released, January 23rd, 2005, it got 3.5 pages in the Sunday Oklahoman, including front page.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah. And it had like 14 photographs in the newspaper, and we had book signings all over. He took care of the book signings out in Las Vegas, and but I went with him up to Tulsa to Steve's up there.
Oh, Steve Sundry's,
and we had a real successful book signing there. We had a successful one at Full Circle, you know, and stuff. And we did a gambling conference at the Biltmore here also. And so it was a lot of fun working on that. He had a great sense of humor. He's a very charismatic person, obviously, and wouldn't have met with as much success as he did. But his casino was legendary. And during the oil boom, it was the highest stakes gambling you could get inside the United States. Willie Nelson gambled there, and ZZ Top, and, you know, all kinds of celebs. And he was good friends with Bobby Baldwin. And who ran the Bellagio for many years, and he knew Steve Wynn, and you know, he was real good friends with Benny Binion, and who had the Golden Nugget there, you know, and stuff. And so he was not allegedly in organized crime, but he knew people that were, and the feds, in order to keep getting more cases against him, they would have to up the stakes for the federal government and say, well, this guy's in organized crime and this guy's doing so and so. No, he skirted it. I mean, he knew exactly what he was doing and how far he could go with it, and it pissed off the authorities, because he would play by the rules, but he would push it right up there. You know, I can remember I sold, when I had my gallery, I sold artwork, corporate artwork, and I went with another decorator up to the First National Building, and I can remember this floor that she was selling some artwork to, and every door on it would say executive so-and-so, you know, executive leasing, executive so-and-so, and all of this. I remember seeing that floor, you know, and I remember that. Well, it turns out he had all of those businesses. And the executive leasing was a business he and some friends put in because the RICO statute had gone into effect, and the RICO statute allows the government to seize your property when you're doing bad things. And so they were seizing all these high rollers, Cadillacs and stuff. And so he's put up a leasing company, and you can't seize leased property.
Oh, so, gotcha.
The kind of thing that he did, and he was very flamboyant about it, and it just pissed them off something awful.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And so they kept trying to get him, you know, but he did know people who knew people, you know.
Yeah.
And he was very good friends with Mickey Mantle. He was also very good friends with Mickey Cohen, you know. So there you have it. That's Pody's world.
My gosh. It sounds like he is, in fact, I was so excited when you were talking to me about this the first time, because it sounds like he is definitely someone who is very much a part of the history of Oklahoma City.
Absolutely. And should, in my opinion, be in the Oklahoma History Center's collection, you know. And he did a lot for the city, too, that people don't know about. And I know he gave some money to a hospital that was a very quiet thing, you know, but that was one of his last random acts of kindness, you know. And he when the ballet, for example, wanted to raise money, he would have Las Vegas night, you know, and he put on a big gambling show for all of the benefactors of the ballet, you know. And when he got arrested, those people were nowhere to be found, you know. I think that's a little bit sad note, you know, because Andy Coates, for example, was our district attorney, and Andy gambled there, you know. And you know, There were, all of the founding fathers enjoyed being around him, you know. And he wasn't cashing welfare checks, you know, to let people lose their money there. He was providing a service to Nichols Hills that they very much wanted. Carl Anderson, you know, and people like that, you know, were enjoying his company very much. I managed a gallery at 72nd and North May, or 74th and North May, and we framed a lot of stuff for people who would go there and have some kind of memento, and they want it framed, you know. So I knew of him, but I had never been there during the disco days or any of that stuff, you know. but I certainly knew people that had been there, and he was a bit of a legend. And then he sort of went away, and we didn't necessarily know why, but he had a timeout.
Yeah.
And so I was glad that his story got told, and I was glad to be a part of it, because, like I said, that thing with David Russell should have never happened. And growing up a lawyer's daughter, I caught that, where he didn't catch it, and he knew law pretty well, you know, but had someone pointed that out to him, that case never would have gone to trial, you know. And people need to know that that is not okay, you know. But there you have it.
Yeah, I just get this sense that he was, you know, that there were, it sounds like he was providing something that people clearly was a demand for.
Clearly wanted it.
And people who had the financial wherewithal to do
and
that.
And you don't run a game in the same location for 18 years by cheating people, you know.
Good way to die,
you know. So he was in the same location for 18 years and nobody cared. He lived across the street from Linda Cavanaugh. So he always knew when he was getting busted, because the cameras would pick up a channel 9 or 4, whatever it was, truck pulling up in front of her place, you know, and you go, well, I guess I'm getting busted again.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, so I guess I would ask you too. I mean, just the time that you spent with him and to hear these stories, it sounds like that he had to have had a tremendous amount of trust in you and feel comfortable that he could share these things with
you.
Yes,
he did.
Yeah.
And that was kind of cool too, you know, and that bothered a lot of people, you know, but we were just buddies, you know, and I got where he was coming from, you know. My granddad manufactured chili here, and he started that business during the Depression. It was called Hilly's Chili, and it was brick chili, and he sold it in about 5 counties around Oklahoma City. And he was in AA's, and that saved his life. It saved his marriage, you know, and all of that. But he believed that people needed to have a place to go have fun that wasn't a bar, you know. And so he started having bingo night at the Western Club for all of these reformed alcoholics. And Curtis Harris, when he was the DA here, raided the place and raided some other bingo type establishments. And I can remember my granddad went to jail over that, and he said, this is a right we have, you know. We've been gambling since before statehood, and you cannot suddenly take that away. And what are you going to give these people to do with their Saturday evenings when they don't go out drinking, you know? So he fought over that, and eventually, you know, we have gambling here now, you know. So that I can remember growing up with that, and I have been of the opinion that, you know, card games or whatever, that's between them and their higher power.
Yeah.
You know, it's not my business to dictate what they do with their time or money, you know. And so when they said, do you want to meet with him, you know, and I called a friend of mine. And her husband was a federal judge, and she was a writer friend, dear friend. She's since gone on. And I said, have you ever heard of Pony Poe? And she said, she answered, emailed back, who wants to know?
Oh.
And I said, I do. And she said, we'll talk. Well, her husband turned out to be the judge in the first hearing that lambasted the prosecutor.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And
yeah.
I did find out quite a bit about him, you know, through other contacts, although my contacts were different than his contacts in the majority of cases, I'd say. But he said, you know, Pody was a fascinating fellow, you know, and Pody admits that he screwed up in the last round, you know, but he, by then he had spent all his money on these high-powered attorneys and had none to fight the good fight, you know, and one of his lawyers was Oscar Goodman, the mayor of Las Vegas for many, many years, and Oscar sent me an email, you know, that he was so sorry to hear of Pody's passing, you know, because, like I said, he was a likable person, you know, in many ways. So, anyhow, I don't make him out to be a hero. He did some bad things, you know, but he lived his life outside the box, you know, and he, you know, he raised a number of kids and tried to provide for them, you know, so that's more than some ex-husbands did.
Oh, so. Yeah. It is interesting, too, because I think sometimes when we look at people, you know, if we try to, you know, I guess there is gray area as well. I don't know if that applies in this case.
Yeah, or... yeah, absolutely. You know, like I said, you know, he, when he started out, he was the person who could tell a joke and keep people busy at the bar, you know, when other people were doing things that were required people not paying attention to them, let's say.
Gotcha.
and so they like to take him along for the ride, you know, and wine and dine him and give him carte blanche, whatever, you know. And that's kind of how he got into that world, you know, and functioned. But he got into gambling because even his dad, he was in insurance big time. He was, and got cheated on a huge commission with the insurance company. So then he went to work for his dad, who produced shows like at sporting events and stuff. He'd bring in starlets. His dad was a movie producer from L.A. and got burned on some stuff out there. And so he came out back west and or came back east to Oklahoma and was doing these various projects and up in Kansas and all of that. And his dad screwed him over.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, you know, he really was looking for someone whose word was their bond. And the place he found it was in gambling, you know, because you go back on your word in there, it can have some serious consequences.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
So he liked that degree of integrity that was there, if you want to call it that. So that was kind of interesting.
Very interesting story. And so if I understand right, you spent about 4 years with him. So during that time, that was the time that it took for him to really share all these stories with you?
Well, he liked to go to restaurants to do interviews. And as it says in Fat is Slow, maybe every fourth word you got on tape. Most of the time it's just clinking dishes, you know, and voices behind you, you know, and stuff. And we would have to redo these things over and over again. And my hand had gotten injured at school, and so I could only type so well. So my sister and her husband graciously sent me voice-activated software.
Oh, okay.
And so I put that on the computer, and it was supposed to make things go faster. And Pody knew this race car driver that I knew. I didn't know him, but I knew of him. And so his name was Chip Ganassi. And he was with the Mario Andretti team at one time. And so Pody knew him, and so he was talking about him. So every time I would say Chip Ganassi into the software, it would type chicken Nazis.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'd have to regroup. You know?
Oh yeah, sometimes the modern technology, sometimes it doesn't work as well as hoped.
So, yeah. So chicken Nazis. Yeah, that was it. And so it took a while to get it done, and then one of the reasons it took so long is because he changed the format on it. You know, the first one I came up with, people said, I wish you'd stuck with that, you know, because it was 100 thoughts, which was something he said to me over and over again. 100 thoughts go through your mind when you start to, you know, do this. And 100 thoughts were everything that he was wanting to spill out on paper. And so I thought it was a wonderful way to organize it. And so he kept talking to his buddies, you know, and stuff like that. And so the fourth time I rewrote it was the way he liked it, you know. So it was a little bit of a challenge. When I first started in, I wrote a screenplay for my own benefit just because that's how I organize my thinking, you know, and screenwriting comes fast to me. So that was what I went with. And then he liked this part of it and that part of it. And so we eventually came up with what it was. And he wanted to call it Rags to Riches Round Trip.
Interesting.
I said, why do you want to call it that? And he said, well, it's what it is. And a friend of mine ran it through the search on Google, and they came up with 116 million hits. And I said, yeah, wow. I said, you know what that means? He said, yeah, 16 million. I said, no, it means that 16 million people will get the call first.
Oh, yeah.
Before you. And once he finally understood that, let me turn this.
Oh, no problem.
Sorry about that.
No worries.
Okay. I meant to turn that off.
Oh, no problem.
So anyhow, I kept talking to him. I said, have you run your name through there? He said, yeah, it only got one or two hits. And I said, bingo.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
That means that when they search for Pody Poe, they're going to find Pody Poe.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, so we finally got along with that. And so we eventually got that book together, and it was pretty amazing. I wanted to proof the first half of it one more time before it went to print. Oh, you've done it.
He was ready for it to go to print.
Yeah, and so Barbara Stanwyck's name is misspelled, so wasn't my fault.
he was ready to have this thing pulled together.
Huh?
Yeah, no, I really do. I honor the. It sounds like this was years of work for you and a lot of effort. And I'm excited about reading it.
Thank you so much.
Talked to you, I have. And that's why I'd forgotten to ask you what the name of the book was, and so I thought I would just wait until I actually sat down with you. So, no, I'm very excited about this.
That's
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, this is, I really appreciate, I feel like this is really, you know, I've gotten much more of a sense of, you know, even after visiting with you briefly before at IAO, just really understanding all these things that you do, and I really honor that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very inspiring.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to ask about it and ask about what all I was into. It was just a lovely evening at the IAO, and look forward to many more.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. I appreciate it, Catherine.
All right.